together to fight for what we love.
And a significant amount of privilege and power over other groups.
You're listening to
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
A CITR podcast.
We didn't get insight and injection sites by waiting for the government to give them to us. Activists and members of the drug-using community created their own safe spaces in violation of the laws, at the risk of being arrested and losing their freedom. And it was only after those places had been opened, after Van Du and others had created those safe injection sites, that finally the government stepped in and helped create one single solitary place in the whole country here in Vancouver. People need a safe drug supply. That's what we really need.
I think it's quite clear that without the sort of sustained activism of many people, especially in Vancouver, we would not be where we are today.
Poverty is a massive issue. Safe supply is a massive issue. Housing is a massive issue.
You just heard the voices of MJ Malloy, a cannabis science professor at the University of British Columbia, and Sarah Blythe of the Overdose Prevention Society. The National Day of Action for Overdose Prevention occurs a few days before the annual 420 celebration, which embraces marijuana and weed culture. Myself, Andy Laidman, together with Sam Jones and Joshua Aziz, began to investigate the ways in which the marijuana and opioid user movements worked with and against each other. In particular, we set out to answer the question of whether the recent legalization of marijuana could impact the decriminalization of opioids and the safe supply movement. To begin to answer these questions, Sam called Sarah Blythe to get an activist take on the situation.
Hello, Sarah.
Hey.
Hey, it's Sam from CITRs.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. I'm all set up here if you're ready to get started.
Yeah.
Sarah lands in an interesting place where she is both a cannabis and opioid activist. As someone who has been involved with both movements, Sam asked Sarah about how she saw the two movements interacting with each other and the ways in which both communities could work together.
How do you think, like, the recent success of the marijuana legalization movement will affect the decriminalization of opioids?
I think that, you know, I think that everybody has to work together. I think everybody together is really, really important. The more people who talk about decriminalization of opiates, and even including the cannabis movement, you know, more people together talking, you know, to these issues and supporting each other is really important. The more people who support something, the more likely it is to catch the eye of the people who need to, you know, that we need supporting it.
What do you perceive as the biggest difference between the legalization of marijuana movement and the safe supply / decriminalization of opioid movement?
Well, people are dying in the overdose crisis. You know, it's a difficult situation, and making sure people get safe access to those drugs is really important. They're different, and they can help each other. And I think that, you know, like allies and understanding of, you know, some of the things that have, you know, the drug war included cannabis, and some ways they were able to get pushed and get through that. So, you know, any kind of help with that, doing, you know, working with drug users groups, building solidarity in a large movement of people, which exists. But the more, you know, the bigger the movement to destigmatize, to have safe access for people, the better, I think. And having a good understanding about what is needed from each group is really important. So getting on the same page, and, you know, I think sometimes, you know, having conversations about these is really important. I think it's a healthy thing to do.
Due to our interest in the policy implications surrounding the legalization of marijuana and the future of the safe supply / decriminalization of opioids movements, I spoke to Susan Boyd, a law professor at the University of Victoria. Boyd specializes in Canadian drug policy and the regulation of women who use drugs. She is also a harm reduction activist and has previous experience working in the harm reduction field in Vancouver's downtown east side.
You know, harm reduction activist, but also participating with allies, moving towards legal regulation of all drugs. So end of prohibition as we know it, sort of as a criminal justice matter.
So from your experience in both that field as well as your academic experience with policy, what societal changes have you seen play out over the past decade or two in response to drug use?
I think since the 1990s, we've had a tremendous amount of change and recognition of the importance of listening to people with lived experience of using drugs or having used drugs in their past, following their recommendations, obviously not quickly enough, but that's a huge change from the past. I mean, with the cannabis movement in the 60s and 70s and on, it was cannabis users and their allies pushing for change. But we haven't seen such a concentrated effort by people who use other criminalized drugs, such as opioids or cocaine or methamphetamine, before the 1990s. It's not to say that there weren't people speaking out about drug prohibition. It was just they were more isolated voices by people with experience of drug use. Part of that movement was the first overdose crisis that we had in the downtown east side of Vancouver in the 1990s, where a public health emergency was declared at that time, too, due to the rising overdose deaths and HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C rates. And that was a movement to end prohibition, but also to establish a safer injection site and more diverse harm reduction services for people who use criminalized drugs and legal drugs as well.
So you mentioned the role of activism in both the marijuana and in the opioid communities. Do you see the grassroots movements as being very instrumental to changing policies right now?
You know, one of the differences between the cannabis movement and the movement now in relation to the overdose death crisis is that more people have used cannabis. When you look at drug use rates, you can see that more than 46% of adults surveyed have tried cannabis at least once. But when you look at the data around drug use in relation to, let's say, heroin, less than 1% of adults surveyed have used heroin in their lifetime. And so you have a much larger population that have firsthand experience with cannabis, and you also have a population that, you know, originally was very white and middle class in the 60s and 70s, and that movement started at the universities to end drug cannabis prohibition and an end to police brutality. But we saw that it moved quickly out of the universities, too, with the Gastown riots. You know, that was a Gastown smoke-in and street jamboree in 1971. People from all, you know, backgrounds came to that jamboree, which was later declared a riot by the Vancouver police. I suppose what became pretty evident for both cannabis users and people who used other drugs, and there's an overlap there, of course, is that the impact of drug use is determined by a person's social class. So poor people, people of color, activists, youth, they feel the brunt of our criminal control, whether that's for cannabis use or whether that's for heroin or methamphetamine use. And so it's never been sort of an equal playing field, and I think that both movements saw that pretty quickly, that the impact of criminalization impacts the most vulnerable and marginalized people in Canadian society. And that's one of the issues, I think, that brings the two movements together, that there is a common interest in relation to drug prohibition as a whole. But because more people use cannabis, you know, more people came to that movement, I think, because of their personal experience.
Yeah, that kind of brings me into my next question, actually. What role, if any, you mentioned there might be a little bit of overlap, but do you see the recent legalization of marijuana playing on the decriminalization and safe supply movements for opioid users?
Yeah, I think there's a huge overlap. And I want to say that in Vancouver especially, there has been an overlap in those movements right from the beginning. And you can see people like David Malmo Levine. He opened up the Vancouver School of Drug War History and Organic Cultivation in 2004, and he gives drug war history tours, and he opened the Herb Museum in 2007, and in that museum it had beautiful displays of the history of herbs and drugs, including opioids. But he was a friend of Andu, you know, the first drug user union that was established in Canada, but in 1998. Same for cannabis activist Dan Magnuson. He joined David a number of years ago at the museum, but he also started in 2016 with support from Van Du, a cannabis substitution project, you know, sort of a harm reduction program where twice a week he distributes cannabis products out of Van Du to their members. There's no monitoring of how people use it, whether it be for recreational or for medical use, but it's in recognition that there is quite a sort of growing literature about cannabis as a substitution drug for people who are using opioids or other drugs to switch to cannabis use because it's less harmful. I suppose you could say that, you know, no one has died of a drug overdose by consuming cannabis, but that's not the same for the crisis that we're in, that people have always been vulnerable to drug overdose when they're buying on the illegal market and consuming those drugs that they bought in the illegal market, because you can't be sure of the quality or the quantity of the drug. But of course, we're seeing these rising numbers of deaths because of the poison drug supply, illegal drug supply, you know, in relation to fentanyl's analog, which is quite different than what we've had in the past. But I do want to point out that people are always vulnerable to drug overdose in relation to using opioids bought on the illegal market. But in that way, we see the cannabis activists coming together with drug user unions who are working with people who are using criminalized drugs that are not, per se, cannabis. You know, when Mark Emery was leading up to his extradition and to the U.S. in 2010, a lot of the activists for harm reduction and for end of prohibition, you know, were startled by, not so much startled, I guess that's the wrong word to use, really helped to fight to keep Mark in Canada. Well, that fight failed. You know, he's sentenced to 5 years in a U.S. prison. But again, I think it was a coming together of the movements because everyone saw quite clearly the harms of drug prohibition, the harms of criminalization. And it's not just cannabis criminalization that was a concern. Speak at forums or go to hear other people speaking. I see many of the cannabis activists who fought for legal regulation of cannabis there in the audience and speaking. So, and I think they would clearly state that there's still much more to do in relation to our new Cannabis Act that, you know, still could potentially criminalize quite a number of people because of the severe penalties that are attached to some of the activities related to the Cannabis Act.
Now that Canada has, like, opened the door to cannabis legalization, do you think that the path forward for opioid decriminalization or a ban on prohibition or anything like that is going to come up a lot quicker than it did before in the past with cannabis?
Well, I sure hope so. I wish I had a magic ball where I could predict the future. I think that there's, around the world and in Canada, much more vocalization of, you know, decriminalized drugs right away. You know, this is a public health emergency across Canada. The number of deaths across Canada, these are preventable deaths. So you don't have just people with lived experience advocating for change. You have public health officers and other leading organizations calling for these changes too. I think it's unconscionable that we would allow one more person to die due to this situation. That's completely preventable. If we would move towards legal regulation, if we could provide a safe legal supply of drugs for people who use recreationally or occasionally and, you know, more regular use, and to have those programs as very flexible and open as well. And I think we could do a good job of looking at each particular drug and seeing what kind of regulation would be the best fit for them. You know, alcohol and tobacco are our most, I guess you could call, dangerous drugs in relation to negative health effects. And we've found ways, whether we agree or not, to regulate those drugs with way less penalties than we enacted in the Cannabis Act. But I think we have plenty of evidence and support around the world about how we might go about regulating other drugs. And decriminalization would be a first step, but I don't think it should be the only step, because as long as you have that illegal market selling drugs, that are, you know, of unknown quality and quantity will still be in the midst of a crisis.
So are you saying something like to begin with similar to the Portugal model and then continue on from there?
Yeah, I would say tomorrow you could decriminalize all drugs. But I wouldn't want legal regulation to be further down the road, because I don't think decriminalization will save us from this crisis that we're in. I think it will certainly affect individual users, that they wouldn't be detained or arrested for possession, and that would be a huge move forward. I mean, in Vancouver alone, 80% of all drug offenses are for personal possession, 2017. Across Canada, of all the total drug offenses, 72% were for personal possession. If we move to decriminalization of personal possession, let's say, like the Portugal model, then a lot of these arrests, you know, almost 80% of offenses would not happen. So, of course, that would be a major step. But if we really wanted to move away from sort of punitive drug prohibition and regulating people who are using substances in this way through a criminal justice model, then I think we have to consider legal regulation.
So with decriminalization as well, it would allow greater resources to prop up as well, correct?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah, so not necessarily. And, I mean, you would hope that that would be attached to that change. We declared a public health emergency in BC in 2016, and we did see more resources and funding for harm reduction services throughout the province for overdose prevention sites, for an expansion of maintenance programs like hydromorphone, Dilaudid, as it's called, by users. We've seen these expansions, but we still are in the midst of an overdose crisis. We can see that the numbers are continuing to climb each year. And so I do believe we have to do something more drastic or more a larger change than just decriminalization.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And just going back to something you said at the beginning of the interview, you said you study women in regards to drug policy?
Yes.
And drug use. Can you touch on that a bit and how that differs from, like, men? And
yes, I can. I was always interested. I was a harm reduction worker in the downtown east side, and one of the things that I saw immediately, or anyone who knows women who are using criminalized drugs, that the regulation of them is quite different than men, and that has to do with women being mothers and gender norms around women. And so where men can be seen sometimes as, oh, having sort of a possibly, you know, risque past, bad boy kind of persona, there really is an equivalent for women. But the issue that really is quite different for women is around reproduction and mothering. And so the regulation of women through social services and child protection really impacts them in a way that men are not impacted. Most single parents or mothers in child protection and social work practice, being known as a person who uses illegal drugs, can easily then put you in the position of having your children apprehended from you. But we also had a lot of sort of media attention on women and pregnancy and drug use, and a lot of myths and misinformation in the media about the harms of drugs to the developing fetus and birth outcomes. But what we do know, what the science and the research demonstrates, is that when women are provided non-judgmental health care and care during pregnancy, they can have the same birth outcomes as people who are not using criminalized drugs. And women really are vulnerable and at risk to having their children apprehended if they are thought to be using drugs or wanting to participate in the activism against drug prohibition. That puts them in sort of a public spotlight that actually could bring harm to them and their families.
Particularly with Indigenous and minority women as well.
Yeah, and that's where I think we can see with all of drug prohibition and the impact of drug prohibition, that it's people of color, Indigenous people, youth, activists, are the most vulnerable for arrest, but certainly in relation to women and drug use, historically it's been black women, indigenous women, poor women who are most at risk for seeing their families torn apart, but also for being sentenced to prison for drug arrest.
While it is impossible to know whether Canada will move to decriminalize or legalize drugs other than marijuana in the near future, in the midst of the opioid crisis, the demand for safe supply and greater harm reduction measures remain pressing issues across BC and Canada. Music by local band Skim Milk. If you haven't checked them out yet, they're well worth the listen. You can find them on Bandcamp. Interview with MJ Malloy was conducted by Joshua Aziz. The interview with Sarah Blythe was conducted by Sam Jones. And the interview with Susan Boyd was conducted by myself, Andy Laidman. Editing and production by Andy Laidman. And thanks, as always, to Alex DeBoer for her intrepid leadership, assistance, and advice every step of the way throughout the production of this piece.